includes Copland's Appalachian Spring, works from Bernstein and Gershwin, and the suite for Klezmer Band and Orchestra by Sid Rabinovich. More information is available on the web at prairieensemble.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Super Value, Champaign; Swire's Land and Management Company, Danville; EAG Company Incorporated, Fairmount; and AgriGold Hybrids, Mahomet. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about the politics of India and about the rise of right-wing extremist Hindu political activists in that country, what it means for the country itself, for democracy in India, and perhaps also what it means for democracy around the world. And we'll be talking this morning with Martha Nussbaum. She is professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago and is the author of a recent book that explores this subject. The title is The Clash Within: Democracy, Religious Violence, and India's Future. It's published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press and came out in May. She's joining us this morning by telephone, and we're pleased that she could spend some time with us. Professor Nussbaum, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks.
Very good to be on the program.
Well, we certainly appreciate you talking with us and giving us some of your time. The place to begin, I think, probably is as you do with your book, and I think, and I know that this is something you have talked about a lot to different places, organizations, and you've written about it. The place to start is to talk about this series of events that took place in the 2002 in the state of Gujarat in western India. What happened there in February 2002?
Yeah, okay. I mean, so I use this as the focal point for my general discussion. What happened was that for some time, tensions between Hindus and Muslims in this region had been building, partly over the whole question of whether a mosque elsewhere in India lay over the remains of the god Rama's birthplace. And so on this particular day in February, there was a train of Hindu pilgrims who had come back from that disputed site where a mosque had been torn down and they were trying to reconstruct a Hindu temple. So these were people who were very polarized already and fired up and angry, and a bit of scuffling erupted on a station platform at a station called Godra. But then the train pulled out, and evidently Muslim mobs had gathered in the area to protest the treatment of Muslim vendors on the station platform. So there was some stone throwing on both sides, and the train, for some mysterious reason, stopped. Somebody had pulled the chain. But then it started up again, and shortly after that, one car of the train erupted into flames. 58 men, women, and children, mostly Hindu, were killed in this fire. Now, immediately, blame was put on Muslims, and the story was put about that Muslims had thrown gasoline-ignited rags into the train and then had torched the car. Actually, later, much later, when they finally got a chance to look at the forensic evidence, that was very dubious. It because of the pattern of the burns on the victims, it actually seems most likely that it was a tragic accident. These pilgrims had brought on kerosene stoves, and they had stored them under the seats of the train. The train was overcrowded, as a great many trains in India are, and so it looks like, because the pattern of the burns was that of a flashover phenomenon, that that was probably an internal cause of the fire. But in any case, immediately there was mass rioting by organized Hindu groups who had stored up lists of Muslim stores, Muslim dwellings, and all over the state, I mean very far from the original place, they immediately set about killing Muslim civilians, and about 2,000 men, women, and children, about half of them being women, as far as one can tell from the remains, were killed in the fire. There was lots of rape and torture as well, and in general, it was a terrible event. But one of the most terrible things was that the forces of law enforcement did not try to stop it. Police were told to stay home. They were threatened with transfers should they try to stop it. And the blame for it goes all the way up to the chief minister of the state of Gujarat, Narendra Modi, who has never been convicted yet in a criminal court, although he may yet be, but he has been denied a visa to enter the United States on the basis of the overwhelming evidence that he masterminded and supported this religious violence.
Mm-hmm. Certainly there has historically been some tension between Hindus and Muslims in India. At least you can look at the experience of partition. At the same time, I think you also have to argue, as you do in the book, that those people who were instrumental in the founding of modern India were very concerned with it being a pluralistic society. What is the historical context here for extreme Hindu nationalism, and why is it that it seems that particularly within the last 10 years it has been something that seems to be growing in its influence?
Well, I think it goes way back because, of course, for many, many centuries, Hindus have been subordinated, first under the Mughal Empire by a bunch of Muslim rulers, and they remember that with great bitterness. And then shortly after that, the Raj took over, and so then the British were making fun of them and subordinating them. So there's a stored-up feeling of humiliation. And this led, in the early 20th century, to a number of people saying, if India is ever to be a nation, it has to be a Hindu-first nation, one that asserts very aggressively a kind of Hindu pride. So that was a view that was already around in the early part of the century, and by the time Nehru and Gandhi were on the scene, it was a pretty powerful view, which they intensely disputed. So both Nehru and Gandhi wanted an India that was pluralistic, that where everyone was a citizen, Muslims and Christians too, where of course the Hindu right doesn't think so well of Christians either. So Nehru and Gandhi wanted everyone to be a citizen on the basis of equality, and Gandhi pointedly included Muslims in his movement. So did Nehru. A very devout Muslim, Maulana Azad, was one of the leaders of the independence movement and of the Congress Party. So they wanted an inclusive India. Now, meanwhile, Jinnah, who became the founder of Pakistan, for reasons that have something to do, at least, with self-advancement, I don't have a very rosy view of Jinnah, he began to try to convince the British that they really needed to be two nations, a Hindu nation and a Muslim nation. And he tried to convince Indian Muslims that they really couldn't live with the Hindus. And so this is what eventually led to partition, as the British always preferred the policy of divide and rule. So, unfortunately, at that time, there was a tremendous amount of violence. Gandhi tried very hard to stop it, and he succeeded in Bengal with his fast unto death. He really got people to wake up and see how bad the violence was. But after that, though, we have to say that for many, many years, Hindus and Muslims lived together and worked together. And, there are as many Muslims in India as in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. India is the second largest Muslim nation in the world, really. So it isn't like all the Muslims went over to Pakistan. And so there's a great deal of coexistence. And certainly in the state of Gujarat, people were used to working together. So it's always a question of what sets people off. So why did the tensions start to build again in the late 1980s? Well, I think the first thing to say is that the Hindu right had always been there, and they were masters of social organization. Starting in the 1930s, they built a youth movement. Nehru compared it to fascist youth movements and was very skeptical of it. And so these people that were very good at organizing social services and at organizing fun movements for young boys, particularly, who then get indoctrinated into the values of this group, and they get kind of militarized and turned into people who might then riot and do violence against others. They did this behind the scenes quite quietly and then eventually emerged into the open with a political party allied to their social organizations, which is called the BJP. The BJP then gained strength partly because the Congress Party was internally quite riven by corruption and its economic policies didn't seem to people to be doing well. So at first the BJP picked up support from not just from people who opposed an inclusive and pluralistic India, but quite a lot of people who were just capitalists, who thought that India should pursue economic growth and so on. And I talk in my book about how some of those people then defected when they understood what the link really was between this party and the cause of religious violence. And so I interview people of contrasting sorts, some who held their nose and stuck with this movement despite its commitment to violence, and some who just got out and tried to reform the Congress Party. So I think there were a number of causes for the rise to power, but what is conspicuous is that not enough people were prepared to say, look, we just won't put up with this. We may want economic growth, but we're not going to have it if it comes linked with this kind of violence.
Mm-hmm. Well, beginning in the late 90s, the BJP was successful enough at the polls so that it had a majority of parliament, and from 1998 until 2004, the prime minister was a BJP man. That was Atal Bihari Vajpayee. And so in what happened then in 2004 when, once again, the Congress Party took over the government? Does that tell you something about people's attitudes towards the program of the BJP, or was that maybe had more to do with people simply being dissatisfied with the BJP's performance on economic and other issues, and it didn't really have so much to do with this other set of issues?
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to say they never had an outright majority. They were always in a coalition. They had to make coalition with these regional parties. So they never were able to institute the program that they actually had in mind, which involved a complete rewrite of the Constitution. And so I think people were always a little alarmed at the prospect that they might have an outright majority. So that's the first thing. Second, they had this economic program that was based entirely on fostering open markets and economic growth, and not enough concern for the tremendous amount of rural poverty and illiteracy. And we know, because of exit polling, that rural voters played a decisive role in the election of 2004. This campaign slogan that they used, India Shining, seemed to the rural voter insulting and cynical, because India was not shining for them. And so they turned out in large numbers. I mean, India is a very, very strong and healthy democracy, in that voter turnouts are much higher than they are in the U.S. And so these people came to the polls and repudiated that. But I think that it's fair to say that they were also repudiating the politics of religious violence. Both Sonia Gandhi, the head of the Congress Party, and Manmohan Singh, the current prime minister, and, by the way, the first religious minority prime minister that India has ever had, he's a Sikh, they had spoken out very, very strongly against the violence in Gujarat and against other instances of religious violence. And, in fact, Singh's first speech as prime minister singled out both the Gujarat riots and some earlier riots against Sikhs in Delhi, which, by the way, the Congress Party was to blame for, as things that must never happen again. So the government started on a basis of being very strongly committed to pluralism.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus, Martha Nussbaum. She is Ernest Freund Distinguished Service Professor of Law and Ethics at the University of Chicago, and is author of a book that just came out in May that we're talking about here this morning, about India and Indian politics, and particularly about the rise of right-wing Hindu extremism. The title of her book is The Clash Within: Democracy, Religious Violence, and India's Future. Belknap Harvard is the publisher. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. If I just might ask, because I know that you have talked about how it is you chose to write about the subject, and that it is a little bit of a departure from the other kinds of things that you write about and teach about. What was it that drew your interest and eventually led to writing this book?
Well, that's a good question. I've been in India a lot, mostly focusing on the ethical foundations of international development. And I've worked on women and development projects, and I've written a book called Women and Human Development that did focus on India and on the educational projects and other kinds of development projects for women. And so all along in my work, which is partly done in collaboration with Amartya Sen, the Indian citizen who won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 1998 for his work on poverty, together we've focused on India. Partly, of course, that's his country, but for me, it's just a country I've fallen in love with, and I really do love India, and every time I go there, I get interested in something else, and so you kind of get more and more immersed. And when the Gujarat riots happened, I knew, of course, quite a lot about what had happened, and I saw that my friends in India had written a tremendous amount. And one thing that we have to give great credit to is the Indian press. I think the Indian press is much freer in crucial respects than the American press, because in the sense that it's less corporate controlled, and it's much easier for a variety of voices to be heard. So right away, there was a tremendous outpouring of condemnation in the English language press, particularly in Gujarat itself, but also nationwide in both vernacular and English language media. And people, you know, professors could easily publish an article on this, which is just something that doesn't happen in the U.S. And so I could see that that was fine. Everyone who wanted to say something was getting their voice heard, but they weren't being heard in America. And I thought, you know, Americans do tend to believe that the world is struggling between a Muslim monolith and the good Western values. And I thought it would be probably a good idea to tell the story to Americans of a thriving democracy that's being threatened from within, not by a Muslim monolith, but by people who are actually Hindus, who I think are quite false to the deeper and honorable principles of the Hindu religion, but who certainly hijack the name of that for the purposes of violence. And, you know, my thesis in the book really, ultimately, is that in every society there are people who are prepared to live on terms of equal respect and people who aren't. And what every society needs to do is to look within and introspect and criticize and not blame some specter of the Muslim international for all the problems that one has. And I agree ultimately with Gandhi that at a deep level the real clash of civilizations is inside every person, because in every person there are urges to violence, urges to degrade the other and to defile the other, and there are also capacities for compassion and respect. And so what Gandhi understood is that it's that level that you really have to start the battle, at the level of the individual heart and soul. So in a way, it's a very Gandhian book, and mm-hmm. I did want to try to put that message across to Americans.
Well, I think that's right. Clearly, that's what the title of the book refers to, and I think that it's important here to make sure that people get the idea that, yes, in fact, this is a book about India and Indian politics, but that you were making the argument here that there is a larger lesson to be learned, and it is something from which we here in the United States could profit above and beyond whatever we might learn about India and Indian politics.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, I mean, I tell the story in great detail because I don't think there's any other way to tell a story. And I think Americans typically know relatively little about the history of India. So I do try to fill in those pieces in as engaging a way as I can with stories about Nehru and Gandhi and so on. But, as I say, with interviews of people of contrasting kinds from different parts of the political spectrum. But I really do want to say it's a story from which we can learn something about ourselves. That I think Americans are all too prone to think that everything's fine in America, and then outside there's this axis of evil, and we're afraid of that, and we better get ready to be aggressive against that. And I'm afraid it's that kind of thinking that all too often leads to demonizing groups and maybe ultimately doing violence against them. I think the kind of thinking we need is much more refined and precise and involves much more self-criticism. And ultimately, I make an argument about education and say that in both India and America, I think what's crucial is that education should focus on cultivating both the self-critical capacities and the capacities for imagining the situation of another person.
You know, that's interesting because I just seem to recall recently reading an article, I think that it was in the New York Times, about the Indian education system. And it seemed to say that, in fact, at least in some schools in India, there was this growing effort to try to encourage in students an independent thinking, questioning of the established wisdom, and so forth, and the thrust of the article at least seemed to be that this was something for India that was new. Now, of course, it may not be something that's taking place everywhere in India, because I think also one of the criticisms that you make in the book is that in some school curricula you're seeing the story of Indian history that the Hindu right would like to propagate, which is far from the real story, so that perhaps the news is not good overall in India, but at least there seem to be some places where they're trying to promote that kind of approach to education.
Well, you see, I think that's not at all new in India, because India was one of the great homes of progressive education. Rabindranath Tagore, in 1905, founded a school in West Bengal, which was one of the models for progressive education around the world. It influenced people in England, in the U.S. It was associated, I mean, it was contemporaneous with Dewey's school in Chicago, and there was certainly a lot of back and forth between the two, although the two men probably never met. But in any case, he was doing what Dewey was doing, building a kind of independent, democratic kind of education that did focus on self-criticism. Tagore was even more interested in the arts and in the imagination imagination than Dewey was, because he was himself, of course, a gifted artist, and so he had his students doing dance and music dramas and so on, and it was a wonderful school, which it was a flagship for a kind of progressive movement in education. But unfortunately, you know, as India became independent and Nehru put forward the idea that what we really need to do is industrialize and be successful in the global market, that didn't carry on. And I would say humanities fell into disrepute. Humanities and the arts seemed like useless frills, and what we really need to do is beef up computer technology, science, and engineering. So the values of the Indian middle class, by and large, today are that it's a great source of pride if your child gets accepted to one of the Indian Institutes of Management and Technology, the IITs, as they're called, and it wouldn't be a source of pride if your child wanted to study literature or poetry or any of the humanities or the arts. So I think that the story you refer to is a story of something exceptional, and something that I see quite a lot of. I mean, I see a lot of self-criticism and critical thinking in rural programs for the very poor that are run by non-governmental organizations. But if you go to government schools in India, I think that is not so much what you would see. You would see a lot of force-feeding, rote learning, and I think you see there a big danger for democracy anywhere. I mean, I think this is a worldwide movement now towards the devaluing of the humanities and the upgrading of technical skills, and so I think we need to worry about our own educational system in this respect. But in India, it's gone very far, and so, yeah, I mean, there are these fights about what should be in the textbook, but not enough fighting about whether children should be memorizing any textbook. It's really much more at the level of pedagogy that this struggle needs to be waged than at the level of the content of these textbooks.
We're just about at the midpoint of this part of Focus. Again, just very quickly, let me introduce our guest, Martha Nussbaum. She is Ernest Freund Distinguished Service Professor of Law and Ethics in the Department of Philosophy, Law School, and Divinity School at the University of Chicago. She is the author of a recently published book, The Clash Within, Democracy, Religious Violence, and India's Future, published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. Looks at the rise in Indian politics of right-wing Hindu extremism, what that means for democracy in India and also around the world. Questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Perhaps you might talk a little bit about the version of Indian history that the Hindu right is propagating.
Yeah, one of the things that concerns them greatly, and I should say that this is a concern now in the United States as well, because the Indian American community wants to control the teaching of Indian history in schools, and there's been a big fight in California about this. They want to portray Hindus as indigenous, that somehow since time immemorial there have been people who spoke a language related to Sanskrit in the Indus Valley, and they lived this peaceful, untroubled life with no problems of caste, no problems of between men and women, no problems of any kind, until somehow the Muslims arrived on the scene as brutal invaders with the aim of sacking temples and subjugating Hindus. And so that's the picture of history, that there was this peaceful and admirable people who had always been there, and then there were these rude invaders, first the Muslims and then the Christian British. So the Muslims and the Christians both come in for a drubbing there. But that the whole aim is ultimately to portray these two groups as outsiders and the Hindus as insiders, so then it can be said, really, India is for the Hindus. It's our country. Now, what's wrong with this? Well, first of all, linguists have done quite a lot of work reconstructing the parent language of all the so-called Indo-European languages that include Sanskrit, Hittite, but also Greek, Latin, the Slavic languages, the Germanic languages, and so on. And, of course, reconstructing the parent language shows you that somehow or other, the people who spoke Sanskrit were speaking a language that was related to languages spoken as far east as China and as far west as Ireland. Well, so what was the story? How did this people migrate. And so theories are always speculative here. But the most common theory would be that at some point, a group that used to live someplace, probably near Afghanistan, migrated in various directions. And one of the places they went was the Indus Valley, and another place some of them went was Germany, and some went all the way to Ireland. Well, anyhow, the Indian, the people who spoke Sanskrit, got there at some point, and they were no more indigenous than anyone else. They were there quite early, but perhaps not as early as the Hindu rite think. And so one dispute then is about the dating of the religious texts. How early are they? And scholars tend to think that the Vedas were probably date from about 1500 BC, but the Hindu rite would like to put it way back, like 3000 BC. And so that's one part of the debate. But then we come on to the question of what was life like in the Indus Valley? Well, you know, no life is likely to be perfectly harmonious, and certainly the problem of caste emerged rather soon and was not going to give a lovely life to the people in the lower groups. And the problem of gender was probably there all along, as it is in pretty much every human society. So they don't like scholars who point out these problems, because they would like to point to an idyllic past which we could get back to if only we could get these outsiders out of the way. Then, you know, you go on further into history and you get to the medieval period where the Muslims did rule over India, or northern India, in the Mughal Empire. And there, too, there's a lot of struggle about how to tell that story. Now, I think it's fair to say that an unbiased story would certainly see violence done by some of these Mughal conquerors, but they would also see the Mughal Empire as, at least at times, a place of tremendous syncretism and pluralism. The Emperor Akbar favored a kind of syncretistic state religion that included elements of Hinduism and Islam. The art of that period was highly syncretistic. And Akbar was a real progressive figure, famous all over the world for his views on religious pluralism. So typically the Hindu rite does not like to say much about Akbar. And they say, well, you know, he did some good things, but really he was not a genuine Muslim. Well, actually, he was never treated as somebody who ought to be declared a heretic because of these beliefs. He was perfectly respectable, and albeit a little bit more progressive than most. So how to tell that story of the medieval period is one thing. And then we get to the 18th century, where in the Indian state of Maharashtra there was a Hindu upstart named Shivaji, who for a time beat back the Muslims and somehow established a Hindu kingdom in that part of the country. He's become a tremendous hero of the Hindu rite. The saffron flag that they fly in their groups is indeed the flag associated with that character, Shivaji. And if you say anything that casts any doubt on any part of the heroic tale of Shivaji, that's really, really bad. There's an American scholar who teaches at Macalester College, James Lane, who wrote a book examining the tissue of legend that went to make up the life of Shivaji. And at one point he says, well, we don't know much about Shivaji's father. Why was he away all the time? And then he mentions that he actually heard jokes in Maharashtra that perhaps Shivaji was illegitimate. Now, he does not credit that. He actually thinks that that was silly. But just for mentioning that he heard somebody say this joke, he has gotten death threats from lots and lots of people. Prime Minister Vajpayee at one point said that he would get Interpol to round him up in Macalester College in Minnesota and put him in jail. So, you know, this kind of thing, the desire to control the telling of the story, has been a tremendous problem for some scholars.
Well, you talked about, and you certainly address in the book, the fact that extreme Hindu nationalism is rooted in this sense of wounded pride, that they have the story that says, you know, we were oppressed for all of those years by the British, and then we were oppressed by the Muslims before that, and that that's something that sort of undergirds this whole movement and fuels that kind of anger. How does one fight against that, even though it would seem that India has been an independent country now for 60 years, even though that just doesn't seem to that really doesn't seem to make sense anymore. It's still obviously something that it is very real to a lot of people.
Well, see, this is what where I think we can also learn something about ourselves. Because I think one thing you see when you study this movement is the role of differing images of masculinity and the real man in this whole issue of religious violence. Now, what Gandhi saw, and I think he was a tremendous genius of the human heart, he understood that to end this kind of violence, you had to make men think differently about what it is to be a real man. You have to get them to understand that the really strong man is not the one who bashes someone over the head with a club, but it's the one who doesn't do that because he's in control of himself. He doesn't need to do that. He's not so frightened. He doesn't need to lash out. And so what won the admiration of the whole world for India and her men was seeing how proudly they could walk forward against these British and take the blows of the British billy club and still stand there with just their naked human dignity. And so Gandhi got people to understand that's what real strength is. Now, actually, after Gandhi, there's no one who's really focused on the symbolic domain in the way that he brilliantly did. I think there's been a gap there, and there has not been a politics that tries to craft an image of who we are as a people, at least not consistently enough. I think Nehru felt economic uplift was the most urgent thing, and if we take care of that, everything else would take care of itself. So I do feel that after Gandhi's death, there's been a gap with respect to the things that he cared about, and in this void, the Hindu right has all too readily been able to recruit young men saying, you know, your masculinity has been insulted, you really need to strike back. This is something that human beings easily believe. And, you know, to fight against that is a very, very hard fight, as Gandhi knew. And so where is this fight going to come from? This is a question I think we need to ask ourselves in America, too, because we certainly have been fed these bogus images of the real man as the one who lashes out. And, more self-criticism is needed here, too.
You say something, make a point, I think, in the book that I think is interesting and worth talking about, because I think that a lot of people would argue that one of the major sources of conflict in the world today is religion. And certainly we know that religion can be divisive. You make this argument that it also can contribute greatly to a pluralistic democracy. And I think that for a lot of people, they would come up with a lot of cases, a lot of examples to say where in fact it did the other. What argument can you make for religion and its place in a pluralistic democracy?
Yeah, I think, you know, people always focus on these negative examples. Now, actually, in the case I study, I think what you really see are people who are political, who have hijacked religion, but who are not deeply religious. Actually, the founders, Savarkar, certainly one of the great founders of the Hindu right, was not religious at all. Some of the others have been religious, but by and large, you know, in the people that I interviewed, and there's this one chapter where I interview four contrasting types of people on the Hindu right, it just turns out that the only one who's deeply religious is also the one who defected from the movement because he thought it's just not compatible with the ideals of the Hindu religion as I have studied them. So I think, religion is a weapon that can be used to do ill, but most of the major world religions, their moral ideals are noble, and they can be used to do good. And I think this is what Gandhi understood very well. He, of course, he was a Hindu in a very radical sense. His version of what Hinduism was a radical version. It did away with caste. It did away with inequalities of gender. And so, of course, he had packaged Hinduism in a very new form. But he did argue that that was the true essence of Hinduism. But what he was able to do is to use symbols, to use emotion, to bring people together. Now, I think in a pluralistic society, you can't have the leadership of the country doing that in a way that's sectarian. You can't have them saying, let's use explicitly Hindu symbols. You need something that's more inclusive, more made up, more constructed. And I think Rabindranath Tagore really understood that, perhaps better than Gandhi, because he wrote the national anthem of India, and it was a song that portrays India's people as having many, many different regional origins, and it mentions the geographical features of India, and then it basically says all alike, honor the moral law. Now, this is a wonderful national anthem. It's, by the way, a beautiful song, and to use the symbolic domain, as Tagore did, in a way that brings people together around moral ideals that they can all share, regardless of their different religions, but to do so in a way that involves music, poetry, that's beautiful, that's emotional and rousing, this is something that nations need. And so I think to say that everything that's associated with religion is bound to be negative is too quick. We need both a kind of nationalism that's emotional but genuinely inclusive, that's focused on moral values. And then in the private sphere, I think each of the religions can contribute greatly to the development of the inclusiveness of the nation. And so, we see movements in Hinduism, in Islam, in Christianity that are themselves helpful. And we should probably have seen more of that. We should have seen more encouragement for that, because I think of what happened is that a lot of the progressive people in India just decided that Marx was correct, that religion is nothing but the opiate of the masses, we should forget all about it, we shouldn't learn about our own traditions. And so they throw religion on the dustbin rather than using it as a force with which they can promote inclusive values.
Well, we have a caller to bring into the conversation. I want to do that and also remind people who are listening, we have about 10 or 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Martha Nussbaum from University of Chicago. She's author of the book, The Clash Within, Democracy, Religious Violence, and India's Future. It's published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. The book came out in May, so certainly you can find it in the bookstore or the library if you'd like to read it. And questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller in Urbana on our line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm enjoying this discussion very much, and it's great to have Professor Nussbaum on this show. The listeners might be interested in knowing that Rabindranath Tagore has a very strong connection with the University of Illinois and Urbana. His son came here as an international student in the early 20th century. And Tagore himself used this as a base when he came for lecture tours. And in the build-up to the First World War, when his views became less popular in England and North America, he actually spent extensive time here being hosted by the local Unitarian community while he was trying to raise money for his progressive school and so on. So every year in October, there's a festival, a one-day festival in honor of Tagore and his contribution, and the local Indian community does a great job of getting together to honor that. It's just a little bit of trivia that people might be interested in knowing.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I knew about the son and about him going to Urbana, but I didn't know about the festival, so I'm fascinated to hear that. Do you know what day it is?
I don't know if the date has been, if it's the same time every year, or if the date has been set. It's certainly something that we have discussed a little bit, particularly last year. There was a guest from India here who was on the program. We talked about Tagore. So it's the kind of thing that people can look forward to. I don't know, caller, do you know, is the date for the festival this year been?
The second or third weekend in October.
Yeah.
Mm. And one more bit about the influence of Tagore and his son. Tagore's son started the Cosmopolitan Club, which was a gathering place for people who were interested in international issues, which still exists. And there's a residence here for people, and they have programming, invite guests in, and so on. And it's fairly obscure. Not many people know about it. But here, 100 years later, the Cosmopolitan Club is still flourishing and still has programming and international students living there together.
Yeah, well, this was the time when Tagore was working out the ideas which then became the book The Religion of Man. And he was very strongly influenced by Auguste Comte and his view that there should be something that was a genuine religion with rituals and so on, but that was dedicated to cosmopolitan view of humanity, not to any kind of sectarian religion. So in his own way, focusing on how this meshed with Hindu traditions, he described what that kind of religion would be, and of course thought that that poetry and the arts played a tremendously important role in it. And so he gave these lectures in 1930 in Oxford, but I guess that a lot of it he was working on while he was in Urbana. One thing I've always wanted to find out is whether during all those visits he came up to Chicago to see Dewey's school, and no one I know has ever been able to tell me whether they have. There's no record of him being directly in correspondence with Dewey, although they clearly knew about one another's educational experiments.
I don't know anything about that. It might be fruitful research for someone to go back into the local Unitarian Congregation's archives to see what records they have of his comings and goings and where he might have been. I know there's some of the local Indian expatriates are doing work on the history of his time here. I can't answer that question myself. I'm not an expert on it.
Well, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. Let's continue. We'll talk next with someone in Urbana, also line number two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, I'm so interested in this program and this the lady author, and I tuned in about 20 minutes ago, unfortunately for me.
Ma'am, we don't have a lot of time, and it'd really help us if you can come around to a question that that caller can respond to.
I remember when I was in the fifth grade, and I must have, I'm 87 now, so that's a long time ago, and my mother and father took Time magazine, and on the front of it was a picture of Gandhi in his white dress or garb, and I took it to school to my fifth grade teacher, and she showed it to the class, but she had just kind of heard about Gandhi in India. But when my parents came to the homeroom or the parents' night at the grade school, my teacher told them about their daughter, who happened to be me, bringing Time magazine. This was about 1928 or 29, to school, and the teacher hadn't heard of Gandhi then, and I had just heard about it through Time magazine. And my teacher told my parents, well, Mr. Gandhi has done more in his white bedsheet than all the British have done in India. And I have never forgotten that, never. And my husband and I, he was professor and dean in the College of Engineering here. We were in India several times, in the college in Kragpur near Calcutta, where they were doing the same engineering studies that they do here at Illinois. And I have great reverence, and so I've been in India several times. And Bombay, which is not Bombay anymore. I can't even remember the new name.
Mumbai. Yeah, that's really the old name. I mean, we've gone back to the true Indian name from the British version of it.
Yeah, I don't know it. If you want to say a little bit more, Professor Nussbaum, about Gandhi.
Well, yeah, I think what this caller's nice story brings up in my mind is the fact that Gandhi was, on the one hand, a tremendously sophisticated person. I mean, he had been in England a lot, he was a lawyer, and if you see the Attenborough film, which is a wonderful film, you can see he just looked like a very sophisticated, westernized Indian in his early career, but he fashioned himself in this simple, aesthetic way in order to make a statement about inclusiveness and about anti-materialism. He wanted his movement to do away with both caste and social class, and so for him to give this model of simplicity and to do his own latrine cleaning, which was a very shocking thing, to ask his wife to do it, where she was quite shocked by this. It was a way of subverting all these stratified notions of caste and also class. And this is part of what has produced, I think, genuine democracy in India. Nehru was from a very fine family, and they had good values, but until Gandhi came along, I think Nehru would never have thought of going in the kitchen and washing his own pots. That was woman's work, and that was servant's work, you know. But he got all these wealthy elites to share the life and work of the common people, and in that way produced a kind of understanding across classes that has fueled the genuine democracy there ever since. And Pakistan just never had that. Jinnah never would have bothered to wash his pots and pans. And, you know, I think it persists. One very nice story I recently heard about the current prime minister is that there's a very wealthy industrialist who came over to meet with him, and he was very amazed when Manmohan Singh excused himself and said, "I'm going to go to the kitchen and make us a cup of tea." Well, I should say that kind of equal sharing of domestic responsibilities is more of a feature of Sikh culture than it is of traditional Hindu culture. But so in any case, he got this not just from Gandhi, but also from his Sikh background. But it is, I think, something very, very fine in India, that there is this sense that the life of the common people is worthy of respect. We're not too good to do this kind of work. And it's that I think we really, really need to keep building in India. And I fear that as the technological elites get wealthier, they may lose this sense of common destiny with the working people.
Hmm. We have just a couple of minutes left. I want to thank the caller and go on and get at least one more. That would be line 3 in Champaign. Hello? Yes.
Question about the terminology of the Hindu rite that Dr. Nussbaum has used. And I think she made a point about, you know, being careful about creating this notion of a monolith. And I was wondering why she preferred to use the term Hindu rite as opposed to, say, something like the RSS or the Shiv Sena, some of these groups that I'm sure that she includes in this term, because the notion of a Hindu rite to me suggests that there is somehow this vast movement of people who believe in a very specific, most Hindus who may be very conservative, may have nothing to do with, say, the RSS or the VHP or any of the other groups. That's one question. The second question was, does the author see the same dangers posed to the U.S. by, say, the Christian rite, if you wanted to use the same type of, you know, monolithic term in this country? I think I'll stop with that.
Yes, and we only, unfortunately, have a couple of minutes. I think they're both excellent points. So, Professor Nussbaum, you can respond.
Well, first of all, I want to say very emphatically again that I don't think that Hinduism as such has anything to do with these right-wing values. So the term the Hindu right shouldn't be read as saying anything about Hinduism in general. But then, yeah, I mean, it's a lot of different organizations. In my book, I do take them all apart, and I describe the interactions among them. And I think it's fair to say that the organizations, up to a point, are linked. I mean, the RSS, which is the social movement, has a very powerful role in the political party. So when I talk about a politician like Arun Shuri, who seems to be, because he was an economist at the World Bank and he's a very sophisticated man, he seems to be quite far from the what one might call the Hindu right, but at a certain point you discover that connection and you see him giving a speech on the Founders' Day of the RSS where he says, "We must not allow the political party, the BJP, to cut the umbilical cord that ties us to the RSS." So I think it's important to stress that the political party has a certain amount of heterogeneity in it, but I would not think that it's ever departed very, very far from its underlying roots in the RSS, and its current leaders are certainly people who have very old RSS credentials. So, you know, one can dispute about whether Vajpayee was a genuine moderate or whether he was just talking a good game to gain more votes. But I think, you know, it's there are links that go very deep in that movement to the values of the RSS. The Christian right in America, of course, it's a movement that's heterogeneous, and any good account of it is going to describe that heterogeneity. And, what is the danger that it poses? Well, right now, I would say that apart from isolated disturbed individuals and perhaps groups of such individuals, there's not much danger of mass violence and killing. So that's a good thing, and I think that's partly due to the leadership that has not advocated that, and it's partly due to the fact that the rule of law has been pretty successful in bringing such violent people as there have been in the Christian right to justice. But that doesn't mean that we're better than the people in India who would commit this. People in Gujarat did it because they knew they could get away with it, and they knew that the police and the state government were just not going to prosecute the offenders. And even now, the people who did this have not been successfully prosecuted because they're so organized that they can bribe and intimidate witnesses, and that's been a tremendous problem in getting justice after the rioting. So I think we have to watch out and not allow the rule of law to be corrupted here. And we find that in India, where the rule of law is strong, they haven't been able to do this kind of stuff, or certainly not with impunity. So one lesson we learn is the importance of the rule of law and good institutional structures in keeping these groups under control.
Just in closing, I think that, again, you're at pains to say that an important point that you're trying to make here is, and you take it right back to Gandhi, in fact, that perhaps the big problem is not a clash between nations or civilizations. It's within nations and within all of us, and it has to do with this, the tension between forces of tolerance and forces of domination.
Absolutely. And I think, when I try to ask myself, what is it that explains the success of the Indian democracy? I think it's that despite these factors, which of course exist in so many countries, these factors of violence and humiliation, they have had, first, a strong institutional structure. Second, a very vital free press, which brings these abuses to light. And third, they have had glorious educational traditions that go to work counteracting some of these bad tendencies by fostering critical thinking and fostering imagining. And then finally, they've had the Gandhian tradition, which in a general way in the public culture has mobilized people around introspection and around self-control. So those forces are, I think, what keep India strong and vital, and we just have to wish them happy birthday, because it is the 60th birthday of the democracy this week, and let's just hope these forces continue to be strong and prevail.
All right. Our guest, Martha Nussbaum from University of Chicago. The book is The Clash Within, the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. Professor Nussbaum, thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.uiuc.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from the Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta now offers a private dining room for parties, meetings, and other events. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff of the Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Soybean futures are down about double digits, and they're tracking the weakness that we have seen today in crude oil as well as soybean oil. As we go out and look at the current charts for the energy markets, we see that December crude oil is now trading at $93.52 after setting new contract highs overnight at $96.24. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars. In Kansas City, December wheat now trading $8.30 down 2. July at $6.87 down 6. At the Chicago Board of Trade, December wheat at $8.04.5 down 3.5. March $8.24.5 down 5.